Good evening, and thank you for coming. Welcome to the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, the seminal document that initiated Students for a Democratic Society and provided a handbook for participatory democracy. I'm Georgia Kelly, the director of Praxis Peace Institute, a nonprofit peace education organization that is based in Sonoma. For those of you who don't know much about Praxis, but I think a lot of you here do, but I'm going to say a little bit about our organization. We host a lot of events like this, like with one with Tom Hayden tonight, seminars and conferences, sometimes up to five-day conferences, and seminars abroad as well as locally. And for the last 4 years, our focus has been on the economic influences on war and peace. And because of that in-depth search, we've been finding some models that actually represent participatory democracy in the workplace, as well as help create peaceful relationships between workers. And this has primarily been the Mondragon Cooperatives in Spain, where we've led 4 seminars and will probably lead another seminar tour next year. And we'll add one in Italy in the Bologna region, there where there are about 700 cooperative businesses in that region. So for more information on all of our programs and the seminars abroad, please visit our website at www.praxispeace.org. And it's not practice, as many people think, it's Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. And we also want to encourage you, if you're not members of Praxis, we're going to start doing more events in Marin, and we would like you to consider joining Praxis Peace Institute. We have membership forms on the table in the foyer. And some of the perks with membership are discounts on selected events, a book club, which actually our book club is so active, not just reading, but also writing. We're putting out a book in 2 months. We will have our first book published by 6 of the members of this Praxis Book Club who came together and wrote a book called Uncivil Liberties, Deconstructing Libertarianism. The time is right for such a book, we thought. So we have just completed that. And the next Praxis program will actually be in Sonoma on January 28th. We are showing a documentary film called Shift Change, which is about worker-owned businesses in Spain, in Mondragon, and in the Bay Area. Actually, they're showcasing some here and in other parts of the U.S. It's a very inspiring and uplifting film, and that will be shown in the historic Sebastiani Theater. Before I introduce Tom, I'd like to just go over a couple of logistics so that you'll know what the plan is. As you probably noticed coming in, Tom's books, Inspiring Participatory Democracy, and the Port Huron Statement are available outside in the foyer, Book Passage. We want to thank them for making these books available for us tonight. And so Tom will be actually signing books after the event, after the Q&A period. I would highly recommend that you get all of the ones that are out there because they really are the handbooks and guidebooks for the years ahead, as well as very good historical analysis of what we've come through. And I also want to thank a few people who've helped make this a success tonight. Julianne Morseth, who is a professor here in the Green MBA program at Dominican University, has been involved in every aspect of putting the event on tonight, so I want to acknowledge her support and help. Thank you. And Keith Wilson, who did this wonderful slideshow in record time, I don't think he began before Monday or Tuesday, really want to appreciate his work on this and doing such a good job with whatever resources he could find. And I did hear that he got one wrong person in there that wasn't Tom, but that's okay. Another activist. And I also want to thank Mariana Schertz, who's brought a group of high school students here tonight and realizes the importance of youth learning about the movements that have come before their era and how what they can learn to put in to the Occupy movement today. So thank you, Mariana. Now, I know many of you know a lot about Tom Hayden, so where does one begin to introduce somebody like this with such a long record of activism? You know he's been a public servant for over 50 years with a lifelong dedication to civil rights, the environment, social justice, and peace issues. He has deeply impacted the landscape of America. Journalists from the Atlantic to the Sacramento Bee have described him as, quote, the single greatest figure in the 1960s student movement and the conscience of the Senate when he was a member of the California State Legislature. The Nation magazine recently named him one of the 50 greatest progressives of the 20th century, and I think we might be able to add the 21st to that as well. Many years ago, this is for the students especially, Tom was editor of the student newspaper at the University of Michigan. From there, he became a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society, a community organizer in Newark, New Jersey's inner city. He was a freedom writer in the South, where he was arrested and beaten, in both rural Georgia and Mississippi. Later, he found the Campaign for Economic Democracy in Southern California, which shut down a nuclear power plant and led the campaign for Proposition 65 that required labels on cancer-causing products. Probably many don't remember that. That was back in the 80s. Perhaps more than any other living political figure, Tom Hayden has defined a movement of successful citizen activism both inside and outside the system. During the 18 years he served in the California State Legislature, he chaired key committees on the environment, higher education, and labor. The Sierra Club gave him 100% rating every year for his legislation and for his voting record on environmental issues. He's taught at Occidental College, Pitzer College, and at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. He has written probably about 20 books and numerous articles, including serving now on the editorial board of The Nation magazine. Tom has the credentials of a state legislator for 8 years of service as an elected representative, but he also has the credentials of a committed activist and the arrest record to prove it. His arrests were for anti-war activism, civil rights work in the South, and the 1968 Democratic Convention as a member of the Chicago Seven. The activist may have seemed at odds with running for a California State Assembly seat, but in spite of much Republican opposition, he prevailed and was elected to the State Assembly in 1982. When he retired from the California State Senate 18 years later, he was given a long and laudatory send-off. The LA Times printed the following, quote, "He was the world-famous radical elected to the heart of the establishment. When he came to Sacramento as a lowly assemblyman nearly two decades ago, he was regarded warily as an invader and outlaw by his fellow lawmakers, some of whom even tried to expel him from the legislature as a, quote, traitor. But in a tearful tribute that lasted nearly 2 hours, Tom Hayden's colleagues from both sides of the aisle toasted the former anti-war leader and member of the Chicago Seven as a man of intellect and principle who inspired them to be better than they were. Tom Hayden is still inspiring us to be better than we are. Please give a warm welcome to Tom Hayden."
Thanks, Georgia. That was very kind of you, and I'm happy to be here at Dominican. Are any of you students at Dominican? We didn't draw the student body. We drew three. A little more organizing work needs to be done. Maybe you can run out and get them. Are you all in the Green MBA program? Yeah. And I see Sharon Jeffrey, who was at Port Huron out there. The eyes are still good, Sharon. Welcome. I want to say something about Catholic universities a little later, but I think a lot of the social movements of the 1960s came out of Catholic circles, and in our view of history, we compartmentalize it so much that there's very little understanding of the various streams of activism, including moral activism, and especially including the Catholic activism, particularly dissident Catholics. I came out of Royal Oak, Michigan. I didn't come out of a political family. I didn't come out of a left-wing family. I came out of a small suburb, and I learned later that my priest was the most extreme right-wing preacher of the 1930s and such a threat to Franklin Roosevelt that the Vatican muzzled him because he was promoting with Henry Ford the formation of an American Nazi party. His name was Father Charles Coughlin. The Vietnam War was very much led by the Catholic lobby in Washington. So I don't mean to simplify it, but only to say that this is the context from which I come, the Catholic context, and it's always good to be engaged in discussions at a place like this. Wherever I go, I try to collect an email list because I publish a bulletin every couple of weeks that tries to be informative or give a picture of reality, especially on issues where I think I can make at least a modest difference. Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, incarceration, green jobs, things where I've had some professional experience or movement experience. So if you'd be kind enough to circulate this, at least be in touch that way. Here, you want a pen? Thank you so much. Now, this evening was scheduled at this time because when I was talking to Georgia, it was agreed that we'd wait till after the election to see what happened. So obviously, some of you must be interested in discussing the election, and I'd like to hear your thoughts. But it was also part of a project of discussing the history of Port Huron and participatory democracy going back five decades to exactly the first birthday of Barack Obama. So we have a lot of ground to cover, a lot of time to cover, and it may be a little awkward, and I don't know how to make it simple. You could probably view me as in a unique position, maybe somewhat awkward, because as Georgia said, I have spent 50 years more or less in social movements. It is true I was arrested. I was one of those strange people that got arrested before entering government. Instead of the other way around. But I've also spent at least 20 years, 25 years in government as an elected official, sometimes winning, sometimes losing, and as an advocate for various causes that require government's attention in Washington or Sacramento. And I don't know anyone, really, and I do get around, but I don't know very many people, if any, who have spent 50 years on the inside and the outside at the same time. The reason that this is important is that it taught me to see things in multiple ways at once, as opposed to seeing things only as an outsider, which I've usually been. And it has affected my sensibility in another way, which you'll realize when we're done tonight, that I've seen so many causes and so many individuals who are classified as extremist or radical or on the margins over time become part of the mainstream. Or to put it another way, I've seen the mainstream shift to accommodate people that it once exiled or excluded. Whichever way you put it, it makes me complex in my thinking. Usually, serious radicals, including in the universities, define themselves through a lot of struggle and hard work as being oppositional. You know what I mean? They dedicate themselves to oppositional lives. They are part of the counterculture, part of the anti-war movement, anti-globalization movement, against hierarchy, against patriarchy, against racism, against. And they draw a conclusion, quite properly, that it's an honorable thing to follow your conscience, to speak truth to power, to stand up against the man or the system. And so they're oppositional. And my perspective is different, and I think it's important for you to understand this before I tell you what I mean. I find it very difficult to be oppositional only because I've also succeeded in being elected with a Democratic mandate to join the Senate of the state of California. There's no place more establishment than the Senate chamber in any government. Senators only recently were forced to be elected, remember, only 100 years ago. It's the House of Lords model. The Senate runs very slowly on Senate time. They're very slow to admit minorities or women. They do not change the rules. They're very, very slow. And so I spent 18 years in such a setting, and I was always an outsider in the way people looked at me and the way I felt, but I was also an insider. I had a gavel. I could force somebody to testify under oath. How much more inside is that? You may classify me one way or the other, a politician who used to be a radical or an oppositional figure who went mainstream, but in fact, there's a lesson in this that social movements begin on the margins, on the outside, but to the extent they're successful, as I'll try to describe for you, they enter the mainstream, and as they enter the mainstream, some of the people feel that they're selling out. Other people feel they're getting somewhere. But it's quite obvious that if you start on the margins with a handful of people and you enter the mainstream, suddenly you're adding thousands and millions of people to your ranks who just weren't there at the beginning. And you should be glad of that. And they don't consider themselves nearly as radical or bitter as the people that started at the beginning. They're more likely to have pretty good feelings about the system if the system delivers on the right to vote or whatever is the issue that they're organizing around. So there's a natural progression in which people start extremely alienated and then gradually find themselves succeeding and wondering if they've sold out. And when they succeed, often they think that they've been trapped and that the success wasn't worth it. And I'll give you an example just from my own life experience. I told you I was raised in Catholic school. I went to the University of Michigan. I became the editor of the paper. I think that was because my mom said that Tommy's always got his nose in books. So at a very early age, like 4 or 6, I was reading books by St. Thomas Aquinas in order to impress my parents and the teachers. Not that I knew at age 6 what the man was saying. I just knew that I was named after him, Thomas Aquinas. So by high school, it was the late 50s, and around these parts, the Beat Generation began over in San Francisco. Some of you retirees probably were there drinking large jugs of wine with Kerouac or Ginsberg or the rest of them. And in that atmosphere, if you felt that that something was wrong, especially if you were white, you would be attracted to this Beat Generation. I remember in high school, I read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I watched James Dean's movies, Rebels Without a Cause. My favorite hero was Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye. Long about the time of the Port Huron Statement, Ken Kesey from this neighborhood was writing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was 22 years old. Above all, Allen Ginsberg was writing the famous poem Howl, which is about Carl Ginsberg. And the thing all of these people had in common, which slowly dawned on me, is that the heroes were all nuts. They were in mental institutions, we used to call them. They were all mad. And so it was very easy in my growing up to feel that to be oppositional was to be mad. In fact, maybe the only place to be would be in a mental institution. Maybe that was the meaning of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that the insane people rebel against Nurse Ratched and the system. I found that an option that was tempting, but frankly, I didn't want to go there. I was tempted. I had a lot of crazy instincts, but I was faced with that as an option. This, if you really are upset with society, you're going to join the ranks of the mentally disturbed, the emotionally disturbed, and you're going to be a Holden Caulfield. All right. Then along came these students that I met coming from unlikely places to up to Ann Arbor and to Chicago and to Madison. They were high school and college students. They were African-American, majority of them, the leadership of them. And then some of them were white. They were Southerners. They were the descendants of a long history that I learned about from them, from the Civil War through Reconstruction, and they were appearing again in the form of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Civil Rights Movement in the South, and they were sitting in at lunch counters and riding buses as freedom riders, very much like the undocumented undergraduates today, who are saying, I will not settle for life in this country as an undocumented alien or whatever you call me. I'm standing up for my rights, and if you want to deport me, deport me. But the Freedom Rider movement was very much like today's direct action by students who are active in the Dreamers movement, who achieved the executive order from President Obama, and I'm sure will now be pressing to make that a law. So I fell in love with these young people. I married one of them. But in a more general sense of They opened a door for me that I didn't know was possible to go through. It was possible not to be insane. You might have to take a risk. You might have to drive yourself crazy now and then. But here were people, 18 years old, 20 years old, who said in their action that there was a purpose in life worth dying for. And it was the vote, in the first place, because the disenfranchisement of 20 million black people in the South had lasted since Lincoln's murder and was the key to the political puzzle in the United States, in which white Southern racist elected officials dominated the majority of congressional committees, including everything from constitutional rights to foreign policy. And so getting the vote was absolutely important because the Southern power structure rested on the prevention of black people from voting in the South. Follow? So it was, and if you went as a community organizer door to door and you asked people what they wanted to do, which is the way you approach organizing, they would inordinately say something like, I was in the Korean War, and before I die, I want to be able to vote. I want to vote. So it was there, the demand, so-called, was there in the hearts and minds and voices of people at the doorstep who were prevented forcibly from voting, the risk of their lives. So the vote was crucial. But it was obviously more than the vote. The vote was just a symptom of the denial of power and the denial of human dignity. But it was more than the vote. It was the need for empowerment across the board, to have a voice in the decisions that affect your life. And we called that notion participatory democracy. You can call it a democracy based on participation, whatever you like. But the idea was that you voted, yes, but you should have a voice and a vote in a much broader range of things. If you're a resident of a neighborhood, you should have a voice in the decisions about development in that neighborhood, zoning development. If you're a worker in a plant, you should have a voice in the numbers of the hours of the day that you should have to work, the rest breaks, the timeouts for lunch. Participation also in the design of what you were producing in the plant, participation in the management of the plant, representation on the board of directors of the plant, an economic extension of participatory democracy. These ideas came, I think, naturally by listening to people and extrapolating. For instance, on our campus, when Sharon and I were there, if you were a white girl and you had coffee with a black guy in the Michigan Union, there was a monitor that observed you, reported you to the Dean of Women, and then it was reported to your parents. And that ended it badly for a lot of families, yanking the daughter out of the university, therapy sessions. It went on. It was built into the institution because the university thought their proper role was to control you down to your social life, and that it was an invisible form of control and not really none of your business, and that you didn't really matter after your parents paid for your tuition. You take what we teach you and move along, but you don't participate in the university. So we knew that this struck at us as students because we couldn't vote on anything, And so the idea of participatory democracy was a wide democracy, a deep democracy, without any limit, potentially, to its extension. Not a blueprint, not a detailed roadmap, but just a principle that as a human being, as an expression of dignity, you need to be recognized in and be part of the decision-making process at whatever level is appropriate. That was the idea. We got that idea from John Dewey, a philosopher long ago, and from a professor in Ann Arbor named Arnold Kaufman, who I think invented his version of it. But anyway, it found its way into the Port Huron Statement that founded SDS. So what was Port Huron? Does anybody know why the Port Huron Statement is called Port Huron? But where's Port Huron? Oh, is it not a port on the Soviet coast? It's not the New Jersey docks. Yeah, it's a port. People think it's a bottle of wine. I want some Port Huron. No, there. He's right. It's a town. It's a coastal town on the thumb of Michigan. And why were we meeting in Port Huron? Because it had a long revolutionary tradition? No. Because we needed a place to meet and couldn't find one. And her mother, I believe, who was a United Auto Workers official, got us access to this center, this education center in Port Huron that belonged to the United Auto Workers. So we drove in the night to Port Huron, got to this camp, sat down, and I had been ordered to write this draft. It was 20 or 25,000 words. It was cumbersome. People really didn't want to deal with it. It was not a manifesto. That would be kind of Marxist. And it was not what you today describe in the 21st century as a mission statement, kind of a corporate mission statement. It was a statement, as in, I have a statement to make. It was that simple. We were stating, in the words of James Joyce character Stephen Dedalus, we were trying to articulate the unconscious conscience of our generation. What we had to say was in us. We had to find a way to put it into expression. That's what it was. And today, by the way, in Ann Arbor, if you go there, the Michigan Daily still comes out. I was the editor of the paper. That's why I was told to draft it, because I was the journalist. The Michigan Daily comes out, and every week it has an insert, an opinion section, which is called the statement. And I asked all around the campus. I've been there recently, and no one knew why it was called the statement. I said, dummy, it's called the statement because of the Port Huron Statement. And then they would say, what's Port Huron? So many things on stop signs, on street signs, on postage stamps, you will often wonder, why is that there? And so that's why the statement is derived from the Port Huron Statement. So we spent about a week rewriting it in small circles. Politics, economics, foreign policy, campuses, strategy. The heart of it was participatory democracy. I will add just some things that you'll never know otherwise, because I'm a dying primary source and you have to get it out of me before it's all gone. There was, for example, a workshop on spirituality. In each of these workshops, the outline of the argument was plain. We are students, we're arriving in the world to change the world, and we are condemning our institutions for rendering us powerless, and millions of people powerless, And we went through the institutions and how we would democratize them. You get the idea. Democratic workplace, democratic neighborhood, democratic family, democratic education process. And there was also an indictment of the conservative religious institutions, which is what brings me back to the fact that this is a Catholic setting. It doesn't appear in the document. Read it. But some of the most lyrical and interesting and curious sections of the document are definitely drawn from something like John the 23rd encyclical, or the winds of change blowing through the Vatican in 1962 at the same time that they were blowing through our campuses. There was actually a workshop on the religion and an alternative spirituality. They labored hard. I remember I came and went. That's why I knew that the statement was missing something, because I knew there had been this workshop. And they finished their work, but you have to understand this. We worked for 5 days virtually without sleep, and we were on a schedule and a timeline, and we had to get the hell out of there and back in our cars or buses and go home. So the thing ended in kind of a crash. Everybody acclaimed it, affirmed it, and gave it back to me to rewrite. But one of the workshops didn't make it simply because the person chairing the workshop slept through. So in a new book that I've edited that's available tonight, because I know you've been waiting for this, it's the equivalent of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's out there. What would Port Huron have said about religion? It's now known. And it's very interesting. In a sentence, it predicted and anticipated what became known as liberation theology by 1967. Well, that's just a small note. I will stop going through the exegesis of the Port Huron statement at this point and say what happened next. We then left. It was issued. It was widely circulated. For various reasons, it became well known in the 60s, and maybe because a lot of 60s people became faculty or journalists, it keeps reappearing decade after decade after decade. It even appeared in the movie The Big Lebowski. It appeared in segments of Mad Men about the early 1960s and the advertising industry and so on. It's been condemned by Robert Bork as an insidious document. He's the one, if Romney had been president, Bork was in charge of selecting the next Supreme Court justices. So our memories are long. It was opposed by Karl Rove vigorously, because Karl Rove was the chairman of the Young Republicans. It was so upsetting to the future right wing that they had their own conference to produce their manifesto against Port Huron, which was called the Sharon Statement. And it was in Sharon, Connecticut, an elegant, elegant suburb inhabited by the 1%, who were referred to, by the way, in the Port Huron Statement on page 23 as the 1% who control 80% of everything. And it was written at the estate of William Buckley, who was a CIA agent, a Republican guru, and the founder of National Review, which that year advocated in favor of racial segregation in the South. Out of that Sharon Statement came the Young Americans for Freedom and virtually every campaign operative of the Republican Party of the last 50 years. Who's to say who will outlive each other, the Port Huron generation or the Young Americans for Freedom? But I have to tell you, if I haven't already, social change, except when it's fast, is a very slow and gradual process. That's what happened. So If we were so utopian and full of ourselves and successful, why? What happened? Well, briefly, there were things that were outside of our dreams and outside of our knowledge. First, the murder of President Kennedy was outside of either. And we thought that we could push President Kennedy towards ending the arms race and redistributing revenue back to civil rights and poverty. We were not delusional. In 1963, he gave his speech advocating a nuclear arms reduction treaty. He signed off on specific gestures. He supported, after first opposing it, he supported the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice in August, 9 months after Port Huron. He had originally opposed the march, thought it would be too disruptive in Washington. Then he welcomed it and had coffee and discussion with the civil rights leaders at the time, including the leaders of our movements. So we thought that John Kennedy was listening to us, and if our voices were loud and clear and our marching feet were multiplying in the millions, we could realign our politics and succeed in implementing the vision of Port Huron, certainly in our lifetime, but even in the years ahead in the 1960s. And there's no way of really knowing. Some people today say, well, Kennedy sent advisors to Vietnam. He would have done the same thing in Vietnam as Lyndon Johnson. There's no evidence whatsoever for that position. He was dead before the ground troops were ordered. We do know that Johnson authorized the sending of ground troops as opposed to advisors on the very day he was elected in 1964 after campaigning on a promise not to send ground troops. That's how we were introduced to the death of presidents, lies by presidents, and secret wars. And then came the draft. So that, for a time, suspended the concept and the utopianism and the hopes of Port Huron. And it spun us into the necessity of resisting the war. It forced us into confrontations. Everything was escalated in a more and more radical direction. The utopian belief of Port Huron was that we could build a progressive majority with students being catalysts, instruments of social change, but that we would get liberals, we would get progressives, radicals, the civil rights movement, the budding peace movement. We would realign the labor movement because we had the support of the auto workers, and we could build towards a majority that could elect a president and a Congress and implement our 25,000-word agenda or parts of it. And again, because you weren't there and you don't want to take anybody's word for it, there's evidence for this. We were not so naive. For instance, in 1964, when President Johnson came to Ann Arbor, he gave the speech that was the Great Society speech, advocating a great society. That was the year that I was going to Newark to knock on doors as a community organizer. Sharon was going to Cleveland, was it? Somewhere, as a community organizer. We believed that the civil rights movement would spill over into an anti-poverty movement and we would keep growing. President Kennedy, before his death, was reading a well-known book called The Other America by Michael Harrington, a democratic socialist who was a person that quarreled with us and supported us. And if it was on the president's bed table for reading, could the end of poverty be far away? Who knew? We would never find out. Because obviously, when you have the escalation of the war, the ground troops, instead of what we hoped for, there were 180,000 young American men dispatched as ground troops to Vietnam in 1965 alone. At the same time, and I don't mean this in a conspiratorial way or a paranoid way, the CIA was doing experiments with LSD. And the experiment in particular was to unleash LSD in massive quantities in Haight-Ashbury as the counterculture was forming as an experiment in thought control and crowd control, a secret experiment. So they were actually doing that in violation of their charter, which of course prohibited domestic spying, which is another reason that we couldn't succeed, because there were spies among us from the FBI and the CIA, and we were 20-year-olds, and while we believed that we could spontaneously overcome everything, we couldn't really overcome things that were secret. It's just impossible. So, the Port Huron vision was delayed, but it keeps coming back in forms that you may not really recognize. I said Barack Obama was born that year of 1961. None of us believed, I don't remember anyone ever saying, in our lifetime, an African-American president will be elected. There was nobody who was saying it was impossible. It's just certain things are out of your consciousness, and yet they're materializing. You don't know that they're coming. You don't know that they're happening. But when we had the 50th anniversary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee reunion 2 years ago, there on the podium was Eric Holder, Attorney General of the United States. And there he was saying to this assembled crowd of all kinds of progressive, radical, revolutionary nationalists, all these veterans of the civil rights movement, now in their elder years, all assembled. He says to them, you know, there's a straight line between the lunch counters where you sat in and the seventh floor office where I sit as the chief law enforcement officer over civil rights in the United States. He made it clear, cause effect, no question in his mind. I'm not saying that one should campaign on that for president, but maybe you should, because the ultra-right seems to think that way anyway, that it was all one grand conspiracy, which is now unfolding step by step. What was accomplished by the 60s and is the foundation for what we're looking at today, let me just read you a list. Were these things: voting rights for Southern blacks, that's 20 million people, and for all 18 to 21-year-olds, that's another six, so 26 million people enfranchised. The end of the Indochina Wars, the end of the compulsory military draft, the fall of two American presidents, the first congressional oversight of the CIA and the FBI, amnesty for 70,000 draft and war resistors that went to Canada, the Freedom of Information Act, which is the first declassification of state secrets, the media fairness doctrine that required people to have an opportunity to reply to big money in television advertising during campaigns, the first collective bargaining rights for farm workers here in California, the first union recognition for public sector employees, the reform of the presidential primary and delegate selection rules, which on the Democratic side required half the delegates to be women at the convention, and both parties having to go in caucuses and primaries instead of just meeting with their donors. They have to have some form of mandate. Books like Howell were criminalized in 1960. The City Lights, this venerable institution down the road here in San Francisco, their people face federal charges for pornographic literature. Now it's my students' favorite document from the 60s. I think it's because it's short, not because of more its grander importance. It's taught in any kind of classroom, anywhere, anytime. I don't know about this place, but is it? But it should be. And it was about to be strangled in the delivery room. It was not to be allowed for publication in the United States. And the list could go on, but I mean, Nixon, in order to respond to the 60s with more than killing, signed better legislation on the environment, on worker protection, and consumer rights than anything that has been signed since. And he did that largely in response to participatory democracy run wild. There were 20 million people at Earth Day in 1970. 20 million organized by an initial organizing committee that consisted of five people. It got kind of out of hand. The right wing really hated participatory democracy. Professor Huntington at Harvard, Samuel Huntington, said that democracy was a disease, there could be an excess, and it was necessary to find some kind of remedy to stop the contagion. So if you've forgotten that, it's because obviously some people would like you to forget it, but I have a simpler explanation. I think people forget what's been achieved because we're naturally impatient people. We have, you know, as Obama says and as Frederick Douglass says, a North Star. As Lincoln said in the Spielberg movie, there's a North Star. And so if you're always looking at the North Star that led the slaves towards closer and closer to freedom, you may not notice the things that you accomplish along the way that temporarily at least make your life a lot better, like a living wage, the right to vote. And I think it's probably a good thing that we forget what we've achieved so that we don't get complacent, but it's really a bad thing if it's just because we've been brainwashed or our minds are completely without the capacity, to recover any of this information, or our teachers fail, or our media fails and goes into default with respect to history. It's also, I think, hard to remember and treasure these things, past and present, because since we don't have a revolution, we're talking here about reforms of the system, you know, letting black people vote, equal rights, environmental protection laws, they're inherently compromised. So if it comes to you from a politician you don't like, you're not going to embrace it. And if it comes as attached to some onerous things, you won't want it either. Let me give you just an example. Back in the 90s, Clinton got very worried about the rise of youth violence. And he was told by right-wing social scientists that kids in the inner city became super predators by age 6 if they were raised improperly, without a man in the home. And you know how moral fathers are. So the man not being in the home meant no morality in the home, meant that the kid would become a gangbanger and a super predator and so on. So he had this huge police buildup and prison buildup. And Clinton was proposing lots of money, billions, for police on the streets, and very little on the juvenile justice side. But there was a meeting that I know about in the White House where Clinton was confronted by Al Sharpton, who at the time was considered a radical agitator and now is a television commentator. And Sharpton was really going after Clinton for his incarceration policies. And Clinton said, well, he said in so many words, we have to make a concession to Sharpton. So they put in this omnibus bill to add more police and longer sentences. They put in some language saying that the Department of Justice could, if it found a pattern of an evidence of a pattern and practice of violations of constitutional rights, bring litigation against a local police department and pursue either a jury trial or a consent decree. And that came from lawyers I know in Los Angeles, the language. But the agitation came from Mr. Sharpton. It got into the bill. The bill got passed. The immediate result of that was that the Department of Justice sued 7 police departments in major cities, including Los Angeles, which had the most brutal and the most historically immune police department of any American city. And as a result, we got a substantial reform, substantial, not complete, but a substantial reform of the Los Angeles Police Department as a result of the events that led up to getting that language in the bill. They agreed to a judge's order to 50 or 100 reforms in order to end the evidence of a pattern and practice of unconstitutional police misconduct. That's a great reform if you work on the streets of LA. The reform was concealed, however, in a law that you probably wouldn't support, you'd oppose, or you'd be uncomfortable with it because it was so one-sided in favor of more enforcement, more police, longer sentences for young people. That is the nature. I'm not advocating it as a good thing, but I'm describing it as a reality. That's the nature of reform in this kind of system that we deal with. And so it's no wonder that people have a hard time loving reform or embracing reform. They always want more, but also the reform comes disguised with a poison pill. Follow? So that's why I think we are what we are. We don't recognize reform in front of us. Another example is Obama passed with congressional leadership $200 billion worth of funding for weatherization, insulation, alternative energy projects, sustainable battery factories in 3 battleground states as part of the stimulus package. Well, at the same time, he and Democrats stopped talking about the stimulus package because they were being beaten by the Republicans over it, and nobody wanted to admit that they had passed the stimulus package. And on the left, the New York Times' Paul Krugman was saying it wasn't enough of a stimulus package. He's completely out of touch because he's a newspaper columnist, and he's saying it's not enough, it's not enough. So the left is reading Krugman saying it can't be enough, and the right is saying it's the first step towards a black nationalist president leading to socialism or some crazy nonsense. So nobody talked about it. $200 billion is not nothing. $200 billion compares to $5 billion that President Clinton got for green jobs. So if you look at it, like if you're a person that is interested in weatherization for the coming storms, you would say, well, we've got $200 billion. Now, what do we do next to double it next time? That's another example of these reforms. And I think we're at a moment now where it's a very good opportunity with participatory democracy to push for greater reforms, a continuation far beyond the last 4 years under President Obama. He's been reelected. He's got a mandate to do more, got a mandate to protect Social Security, social programs. He's got a mandate to get out of Afghanistan as he got out of Iraq. And he has a mandate to raise taxes on the rich. Now, he doesn't have a mandate to drive us over the fiscal cliff, but that's a pretty big mandate right there for the first month. And I want to suggest to you that you should, whatever your aspirations are, you should think long and hard about making a four-year plan and try to figure out how your dreams can become his mandate, his legacy. I met Benny Thompson as an old friend of mine. He's a congressman from Mississippi. He was a kid back when I was in Mississippi. He rose to a seat in Congress, and I was talking to him a couple months ago in Washington, and he said something very wise that I'm trying to leave with you, that Obama has made history. It's really incredible, a black president in this country. Just watch the Lincoln movie and see the heaviness of that achievement. But it's terribly problematic to think of your greatest achievement having been reached on the day you're elected, right? So Benny says he's made history. Now he's got to make a legacy. And a light went off in my mind. I'm thinking, that's right. That's right. This president is an ambitious person. He's a deep student of history. He wants to do big things. He has 4 years. He's not running again. So we can't pressure him by voting or not voting for him. What's the pressure? The pressure is legacy. Number one, it's right on the table now to protect those social programs. Number two, it's to take advantage of the horrors that are occurring to us with great frequency, to bring back the issue of a stimulus and job creation around saving the environment. It's to issue a clarion call to end or reverse or abate global warming. It's to spend more money on ending global warming. It's to put the corporations' feet to the fire. Those of you who are here in the MBA Green Program are now catapulted onto the front lines of what will become, I think, the epic journey of your generation, which is to save the planet for yourselves and for our kids. And it's been so hard to get political attention to this issue, but, you know, when you lose New Jersey and you lose New York, and you've got one candidate saying, let's privatize the cleanup, turn it over to the private sector, and another candidate, like the governor of New Jersey, the governor of New York, and the president now of the United States, saying there's a role for government here, and rebuilding has got to be on the basis of environmental standards. Rebuilding and reconstruction has got to be green. And that means the industrial unions, the building trades, the welders, the caulkers, the people that do the material work in our economy are far from obsolete in the face of the so-called electronic side of the economy. They're central. So that's a big legacy opportunity for the president. And we can't wait on him, but it would surprise me if he doesn't see it and just wonder, is there anybody out there that's going to build a movement strong enough to make it possible for me to go to the maximum on efficiency standards, on green architecture, and the rest of it? The Dreamers, I think I already said, I'm sure they will be fighting for immigration reform. If the government doesn't give it to them, that sets up a conflict in 2014 with the Tea Party people over on the Republican side. In the meantime, they're likely to get, I think they're likely to get the DREAM Act regulations turned into law, permanent law. I think the list is probably going to unfold from crisis to crisis, but I do think some increase of taxes on the rich, some green infrastructure. I think Obama has a great chance to finally stick it to Wall Street. They made their move. They threw all their money behind Romney. Now they're coming around trying to make nice. Thank God that Obama is not only a community organizer, but he went to the Chicago School of Politics. So you don't make up with the people that have been trying to destroy you without extracting something, without sticking it to them with an invisible hand, of course, because he's a gentleman, but in a way that they will feel it so profoundly that they'll never try it again. He'll put, if I know him, he will put Elizabeth Warren and three or four senators out front in a four-year campaign to turn Wall Street upside down and make it serve the needs of Main Street and this country. And they'll have little to do. What are they going to do, vote him out of office? So there's a huge advantage there. There's many, many other examples that I could give, but that's kind of the recommendation I have, that what your dream, if your dreams can match his need for legacy, you'll succeed, but not without a great movement, not one unified movement, but there's a DREAM Act movement, there's an immigrant rights movement, there's an environmental movement, there's a labor movement. They come together when they can, but each pursues their own stream of pressure on this president. And in closing, I just want to read you one quote that kind of summarizes what I have been trying to get across without making you feel too hopeless. After the women got the right to vote, it had been a continuous struggle for 100 years just to get the right to vote. Two of them, Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers Fuller, wrote the following statement, which I hope will be left indelibly in your hearts and minds. Hundreds of women gave the accumulated possibilities of an entire lifetime. Thousands gave years of their lives. They gave constant interest and such aid as they could. It was a continuous, seemingly endless chain of activity. Young suffragists who helped forge the last links of that chain were not born when it began, and old suffragists who forged the first links were dead when it ended. It's a long process. You have to continue the process and build the best life that you can in the midst of it, because it will never end. Good night. Thank you very much. Now I'll tell you one other, just an example. I forgot one thing. Please come on up. Please think of it this way. I was thinking of this on the way over. That some people say, "Geez, you really accomplished a lot in the '60s. All these things you listed—5 years, 6 years." And it's true. It's a puzzle. But if you think of it another way, it was not a short period. It was like the suffragists. We just didn't see the past. Here's what it was like. In an old growth forest, the trees grow in their own way through darkness and through dangers from loggers, from predators, trying to shelter life as they can. But they grow in darkness. They're unseen until a time comes when the upper branch finally reaches the sky and has the canopy effect, the ecstatic explosion of growth into the light. That's what the 60s were like. We were just an extension of an old growth forest who felt that we were brand new, that we had given birth to ourselves somehow. And Obama is a branch of the same forest. And the canopy is always being recreated. And there's no way to know what's growing now in the old growth forest and is about to burst. That's a way of saying you should be joyful if you have any moments of the exuberance of the light, but realize it all rests on what had to grow out of the soil and the darkness. And be thankful. Thanks very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Tom, for that incredible perspective across your career. So let's give him a hand again. So before we have time for question and answer with Tom, I'd just like a few moments of your time. My name is Julianne Morseth. So tonight it's my honor to make a request of you to thoughtfully consider a donation to Praxis Peace Institute. Why would I say it's my honor to make this request of you? Because since I first became aware of Praxis Peace Institute 6 years ago, my favorite way to describe it is as a small but mighty organization. So it's an honor to be part of this organization and to support it. As a citizen, I've benefited from Praxis events because they always offer me leading-edge insights to advance civic participation and our democracy, our participative democracy, as Tom so wonderfully explained to us tonight. It was wonderful to be among the first Praxis group of Americans to visit the Mondragon Cooperatives in 2008, and for me to experience directly an alternative economic model our country so desperately needs. Each year since then, Georgia Kelly, the director of Praxis, a small but mighty individual herself, has taken a new group to Mondragon Cooperatives each year. Through such experiences and education, Praxis helps me to be a better citizen. I'm also a teacher here in the Green MBA program with Dominican School of Business and Leadership. As a teacher, I've been amazed at the way Praxis events consistently feature leading-edge speakers, authors, and activists like Tom Hayden. Not only do these events enrich my own learning as a teacher, but they also offer students from all over the Bay Area new views about intelligent alternatives within politics, economics, and social justice. Praxis events, speakers, and resources provoke for us all the critical thinking needed to make the world a better place. When we are well informed, we can think deeply and then act, the very meaning of the word praxis. Your donations to Praxis will support more Bay Area events with leading-edge speakers, more education on intelligent alternatives in politics and economics, more scholarships for people to visit the Mondragon Cooperatives, more resources for the Praxis Peace website, and a new direction for Praxis publishing. As Georgia explained to you earlier, we are publishing a book on civil liberties, which is probably the first comprehensive critique of libertarianism and written by Praxis members. And we need your donations to help with that publishing. So this small but mighty organization keeps moving forward and needs your continued support. After the event, would you please stop by the Praxis table in the lobby and make a tax-deductible contribution of any amount that you can afford. You may also donate at the website praxispeace.org. Thank you to all Praxis members. Thank you to those who will become new members tonight. And I look forward to seeing you at future Praxis events. Thank you. And now we will have a question and answer session with Tom. And Georgia, you want to come up?
I can repeat if you want. Oh, okay.
Is this on? Oh, yes, it is. Okay. For anyone who would like to ask a question, you can come up and either stand in line here or sit on the chair until your turn.
First of all, I want to say thanks for being a coherent voice for your activism, but also being a coherent voice to collective aspirations.
Thank you.
I struggle personally, with activism, you do bright lines, and there's a tendency to hate the other side and vilify the other side. And some of that gives you the energy that keeps you going forward. And I think that you've kind of addressed it, because I see you of having both roles of having that stridentness, but also your role in the legislature and the response of the Republicans tearfully saying goodbye to you when you left, of being able to work across lines and see the human side of people. And you kind of addressed it a little bit in the kind of compromises that have to be done. But I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that, because I kind of struggle myself with trying to keep the human element there and figuring out what my role should be. So if you could talk more about that, I'd appreciate it.
I don't mean to give long answers, so forgive me. I'll be brief. I think we have limited free will. I think that we're driven by forces that we don't always understand, and hate is a predictable reaction, and you're right, it does drive a lot of movements. They simply can't stand living the way they're living. They won't put up with it, and they have an understandable reason to hate who they think has done this to them, whether it's an individual, an overseer, a class of people, whatever. And I guess if you look at it from the point of view of an administrator or another observer, the key response is to prevent hate by taking sufficient far-reaching steps to keep it from getting that far. And I've always been a student of why people don't. You know, you can always look back and people say, I didn't see it coming. You know, and you say, well, weren't you warned? Weren't there numerous studies that this might happen, that if you neglected these people that it would blow up? So prevention in social policy and economic policy is, to me, the way to avoid hatred getting out of hand, because the bad side of hatred is dehumanizes the opponent, and it also reinforces the most extreme positions and cannot translate into governance, right? And it leads to burnout. And if you can't kill off your oppressor, then you start attacking each other. And then you start bordering on suicide to attack yourself. And it's not, there's no one I know says that health is a that hate is a healthy foundation on which to build a social movement, but it's there. I mean, I don't think you can just say no hatred, put up a sign. That's the best I can do. And I've been filled with hate. I know what it's like. And I don't know if how many of you have. How many people here have hated someone? Oh, yeah. Well, you notice that you can't remember what happened when you were in that hateful state. Somebody later says, "What the hell were you doing?" I said, "I actually don't know." People lose their minds. They mean it, and who needs that? But how to keep it from happening? I think that's a mark of good leadership, and look at Obama. He's trying to be as unhateful as possible, and the number of Americans who dislike black people has increased by 4% in his first 4 years of the presidency. So there's a way in which even his approach, which many people think is mild and moderate, doesn't stop the inflammation of the hate. Yes.
Great. I also want to thank you for being an inspiration and for sharing the chapter that was left out with spirituality from the statement.
I leave it here for.
Great. That's a reason alone enough to buy the book, and that needs.
It's not in that version.
Ah. Okay. Well, we'll have to get the other one then too.
The other version.
Okay.
Find it on the table. Yeah.
Speaking about environmental health and awareness, two of the issues, one on Prop 37, where at least a couple of days ago, 3 million votes still weren't counted, but yet the results were already announced election night. And
this also on GMO labeling?
Yeah. Gotcha. And also with the rolling out of the smart meters, the digital radio frequency emitters that are being placed on people's homes having health consequences. Any comments or reflections on how the organizations that are doing work, stop smart meters, et cetera, can be more effective?
I don't know on the second one at all. And on the first one, I didn't follow the nuts and bolts of the campaign. I mean, if you have little money and the other side has $41 million, you're likely to lose. But sometimes the fault is in the campaign, in choosing to engage the campaign, and what constituencies you solicited. I have a feeling that it was not a very well-run campaign. It was more like a Hail Mary pass, to use another Catholic example. And it could have been won. Because, God, we label everything, right? Don't you? No, other things. I mean, look at your toothpaste. Look at the sugar content of your drink. The labeling is not an unheard of idea. But they managed to scramble the issue enough that we lost.
Thank you.
Yep.
We're only probably going to have time for one more question, and then people can ask questions from you when you're out at the table and signing books. So.
Well, now thank you, Tom, for...
Did you do that slideshow?
No. This was this fellow here.
Thank you. Thank you. The person who's not me... I want you to send this to him, because he would like to be me, perhaps. His name is Vinny Intandi, and he teaches at a community college in Florida, where one of the students is the guy that shot and killed Trayvon. He's a professor. He looks like he's 12. He's a full professor with tenure, and he... He's an expert on nuclear weapons, and he teaches in Florida. Yeah.
Well, you've been inspiring me for many years, to the point where back in the 60s I formed an SDS chapter at my high school, which at the time was considered a very dangerous and sort of radical thing to do.
Sure it was.
But as regards, I wanted to hear your thoughts from having spent a lot of time in politics about the period that we're moving into now. One of the things that really shocked me, and I think a lot of other people, was this debt ceiling fiasco in 2011, where essentially the Tea Party said, no, we're going to tank the credit rating of the United States in order to win concessions. And I think that probably alarmed a lot of people. So we're now heading into the negotiations over the so-called fiscal cliff.
Yeah.
And the political question for me is, this is going to be the signal as to how the Republican House is going to proceed for the next 2 years. And so I want your thoughts on where you see that going.
I don't know. I really believe you have to let some things play out. Because right now, you know, they're suffering through a lot of shock and reevaluation. In general, I think that they're going to dig in and fight to the finish, the Tea Party. And it'll be settled perhaps in the 2014 election, not before, which means you won't have a House of Representatives to cooperate with the Senate or the President, except on modest necessary measures now and then. One thing that happens a lot on the left is, I was mentioning Krugman, there's people that are... they always want more than is possible. And that's good. But I'm not sure that they realize that what they're demanding is more than is possible. I just think that sometimes they believe that if the president was louder or bolder, they could achieve what they want. And it means that they're always frustrated because the politician, in this case the president or whoever it is, will never and should never, he'll never do as much as what a movement wants. It's not possible. The movement is always going to be out in front, which means the movement is going to feel that they didn't get their way. And in a sense, the movement is being used because the politician wants to be considered in the center, right? So the politician needs people on the left yelling at him and people on the right. Then he can say, well, I didn't go with the extremes, I went with the middle. So if you've been working and working and working on Medicare for all or Canadian-style health care, something like that, and all you get are these exchanges, you've been useful to Obama because he needed the pressure, but you'll feel defeated even though 33 million more people are eligible on the rolls. And as Romney pointed out last night, the president gave things away, like free contraception. That was to get the young girls. Sorry to say that here at this institution, but that's what Romney said Obama did in order to get the youth vote. So it's a tough one. I mean, I don't think if I was advising him, I'd say go after Wall Street and get the best deal you can on the budget, because if you do go over the cliff, whatever that means, it can't mean good things for the reputation of the president. And you did, the voters didn't vote for you to go over the cliff. That's where the Republicans have him. But the voters didn't vote to let the rich off easy on taxes either. So that's where Obama has the Republicans. So I think it'll come out in some kind of compromise that leans much more to the Democrats, but he can do much more on Wall Street reform and on green infrastructure, because they have some executive powers and appointment powers, even if the Republicans in the House don't want to go along. And I think that the Dreamers may get a law because the Republicans are really, really freaked out about losing all Mexican voters forever. And since they already support the notion of the Dream Act, they, remember they said, we just want to do it a different way, they could throw in a few votes and make it legal as opposed to a regulation. So there are some things where the Republicans might collaborate with the Democrats. But I know I share your anxiety. It's a very tough. You keep your eyes on the prize, and you look at the, you know, what's on the table that you can actually get. I think the Lincoln movie was written by somebody who agrees with what I'm saying, and they put all this stuff in Lincoln's mouth. I hope he said it. But listen carefully. It's like Lincoln reincarnated as Lyndon Johnson or something. It's a very interesting movie politically. He says, of course, he says to the anti-slavery people, of course I can't be anti-slavery. If we take that position, more states will secede, and then there'll be no country at all. But at the end, he's banging on the table saying, this is all about ending slavery. Same person. And the way that he transitioned is kind of an extraordinary depiction by Daniel Day-Lewis of how a movement can influence an individual. Dynamics can change. And maybe what you really wanted in your heart of hearts can suddenly become possible. And then you have to take it. You have to be ready to go for it. And I think it's a very modern movie. It's very good. Thank you again very much.